This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moskowain. For many of us, living to a ripe old age is something to strive for. The golden years are depicted as a time to savor life at a slower pace, with more space to enjoy hobbies, travel, and friends. And of course, this is true for many people. But the reality is old age can also bring huge challenges, changes in physical and mental health, the need for care, the cost of care, and concerns about the impact on family. And the United States is about to undergo a major population shift. If census projections hold up, there will be more older Americans than children in just 15 years, and two-thirds of our elders will need some sort of long-term care. Are we ready? And if not, what systems need to be put into place so that America's aging population is supported? Joining us this hour are Lisa Walk, Chief of the Division of Geriatric Medicine and Associate Professor of Medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Welcome, Lisa.
Thank you.
And Norma Coe is Associate Professor of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the Perelman School of Medicine. Hello, Norma.
Thank you.
We're taking calls and comments at 888-477-9499. Send us an email at radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. There is so much to talk about. It's tough to know where to begin. But why don't we start by defining how the body changes after the age of 65? Saw this in one article. Older people are not wrinkled 45-year-olds. Lisa, why don't you get us started?
Okay. Well, thank you again for having me.
So, sure.
To start off with, obviously, we have physiological changes that all of us undergo as we get older. There's no set magical number, so it's not, boom, you turn 65 and all these things will start to happen. We tend to consider older age 65 because of Medicare, and that's where we can get data. But as we age, and some of the changes start earlier in our 40s and our 50s, we do know that there are physiological changes. People have more difficulty with hearing, for example. Your vision changes. The shape of your eye actually changes.
Really?
Your vision changes. So people will notice you have more difficulty seeing at night. Night vision, sometimes people will pull back, particularly because of the glare of headlights coming the other side. You notice your eye can't shift quite as much. So, and again, those things don't start just at 65. They start a little bit earlier. So we know that there are changes that all of us go through as our bodies get older. And part of what we do in the field of geriatric medicine is to recognize and know those things and help people adjust and adapt and in some cases overcome those changes or at least know what to expect. And so yes, we all have changes that we have as we get older.
So Lisa Walk, at what point does an older person need ongoing care and support?
So that varies per person. Certainly, again, it's not a specific age, but when you start to notice that your functional abilities or what you're able to do living independently, you're having more difficulty doing that, that might be a time to start saying, well, do you need a person or services or things that will help?
So when you say more difficulty, what do you mean?
Yeah, so let's say that in terms of doing household tasks, the things you need, what we call activities of daily living, your shopping, your food preparation, that you're maybe having more difficulty carrying the bags to get them in, or it's more difficult for you to stand up to do the cooking or the housework. Your house is just too big to clean anymore. You might consider then either hiring someone to help with those things or consider a different means of getting them, a online service to deliver your food instead of you going shopping. So sometimes those are subtle, small changes that you start to notice, and you can make an adjustments with those things. So,
well, let's get to the bigger things.
Yeah.
Because this hour is going to fly by, and I'd like to get next to the options such as aging in place at home,
right,
assisted living, nursing home care.
Mm-hmm.
So at what point do you know it is time to look for some serious help in terms of being able to navigate life?
So the time that you need to consider potentially moving beyond where you're living is when you cannot get services within your house to keep you safe and to have you do your daily activities. If you can hire someone, you can have a 24/7 person that lives with you and helps do all those things if you can afford that. If you can't and you need more difficulty in terms of doing your day-to-day activities, that might be a time that you're considering an assisted living where you can have aides and things that are available there to help you. Or if you needed even more care or more day-to-day help, that might be a nursing home that you would consider later on.
And so you mentioned the word afford, Lisa.
Yes.
So let's bring Norma Coe into the conversation here. Let's talk about assisted living first and affordability. Does it generally work as advertised, especially if health issues increase as the person ages? Do you know offhand, Norma?
In terms of affordability, there's definitely concerns. There's a recent article in Health Affairs where they did projections where just over half of middle-income Americans won't be able to afford an assisted living facility.
That's middle-income, not necessarily low-income.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Expensive option.
It's expensive option. So it's, you know, on average about $48,000 a year for an assisted living facility. Right now, the maximum Social Security benefit that you can get won't cover that.
What about a skilled nursing facility?
Skilled nursing facility average is about $100,000 a year. In the Philadelphia region, $120,000 a year.
And how do people normally afford that? People of limited or moderate means?
So Medicaid does step in if you become poor enough to qualify for Medicaid. And actually, Medicaid pays for over half of long-term care in the United States today. Medicare by design, which is the health insurance for the elderly, by design does not cover long-term care.
Nursing care homes often get a bad rap. Let's compare them with assisted living. Nursing homes are regulated and inspected more than assisted living. Is that the case?
Yeah, nursing homes are actually one of the most regulated industries in the United States. So yes, they are highly regulated. People are assessed on a regular basis. They are under a lot of regulation and scrutiny.
And can I just add,
sure.
Assisted livings aren't regulated at all. So there aren't any rules and regulations as there are for nursing facilities in terms of the quality of care or what services they have to offer in an assisted living.
I'd like to get to a tough issue, I guess, right off the bat, as far as, you know, elderly people who are living in either nursing homes or assisted living. Apparently, the rate of elderly people who kill themselves who are in long-term care is underreported. And Lisa Walk, as you know, for many of these people, you know, the transition from home to, a different, a completely different place, a room, maybe no animals, maybe, you know, you're losing a lot of your furniture, your pictures, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That can be wrenching. And my understanding is that the oversight at some of these facilities, it's just not enough to really take care of everybody and keep, you know, a really close watch on many people. Is that your understanding?
I mean, there's a wide variety and variation in terms of the quality in different nursing facilities. And so part of what we're talking about is planning. And so since there's a good likelihood that you may need to either hire someone or move to a different location, I recommend with my patients and their family members, they start looking at places earlier on, not when just at the point that you need it, so that you have time to be able to go. Most places will give you a tour. You'll be able to talk to some of the residents. You can get a sense if this would be a place that you or your loved one would want to be before your back is up against the wall and you have to move in. And so that gives you the options to make sure you're in a place that seems like it would be a good fit, that yeah. It's a good location for you.
And I'm not trying to, you know, paint every facility, obviously, with the same brush, but I was just looking at this interesting, you know, this article from Kaiser Health News about this issue. At what point, Lisa Walk, do you have that conversation? You know, I mean, is it 10, 15 years before something might happen, before, say, you're in your mid to upper 80s? You know, you have that conversation with your children or friends or other loved ones?
Well, there's no earlier is never a bad thing. But typically when it looks like it might be about 2-3 years, you're starting to notice more of a decline. If someone's steady or stable with their functional abilities, less of a concern. But you're noticing maybe a little bit more difficulty with driving, a little bit more difficulty managing the house, maybe finances or forgetting to pay some bills. You're starting to see some evidence that managing day-to-day activities in your home environment is becoming more challenging. So that's the time you want to start looking if that's something that you're considering, either assisted living or certainly with a nursing home. Many places will have a long wait list as well. So it may not be that you say, I want to go in next week and they have a spot for you. And so not only do you get a chance to look and see if it's a place you want, but you do all the paperwork. There's a lot of that to do. You can get on the wait list. And then if a spot becomes available before you're ready, you just say you're not ready yet. They put you back on the list. So, you know, most of the places, and particularly a place that you might find more desirable, can have a 2-3 year wait list. So you want to do it earlier rather than right at the time you need it.
And one more question before we move on. What are the signs of despondency in a person who happens to be older?
Well, so you're looking for anything that you consider more like extreme depressed mood, right? So they're not participating in activities that they used to do. Maybe they got together with friends or went out for dinner. They're no longer doing that anymore. Participating in family events. If they like to have hobbies, crochet, read books, papers, they're not doing any of that anymore. So you see them kind of withdrawing. And so things that you know that they used to enjoy, they are no longer participating in, even though they physically could do so, that's a sign that someone's getting a little bit more despondent.
Let's move on to some of our comments. They've been coming in since before the show. Aaron says, long-term care really needs to be a part of Medicare. Normica, what do you think?
So there's my personal views, and then there's how are we going to pay for it question.
Well, let's take both. I mean, I think most people would probably agree that that it would be wonderful if Medicare were to cover this.
I think that there's a lot to argue to have some sort of program, whether it's inside of Medicare or a slightly different program set up to cover long-term care. Like I said, you know, people can't afford this. We've relied on informal caregivers, on families, predominantly women, forever, and we are we're not in the same demographic place as we used to be to have women in the home that weren't working ready to take on this informal caregiving role. Yes, it would be great if we could come up with a plan to both pay for it responsibly.
Yeah, the economics.
There's very, very serious economic consequences to be thinking about on how we're going to structure a benefit like this. But states are taking some steps. The state of Washington passed a long-term care insurance plan just last year. So some states are you know, not waiting around for the federal government to make these decisions for them.
Long-term insurance at one point seemed like a great idea, you know, in perhaps even to this day, buy a policy in your 50s or 60s to guard against the high costs of you know, living with an illness or disability. But in recent years, the market has faltered. Why is that, Norma?
Yeah, so we're down to about seven, less than 10, definitely about seven companies that are selling nationwide at this point. It used to be in the hundreds, so 10, 15 years ago. It's a product that nobody wants to think about buying. And so it becomes it's a product you sell. It's not a product that people actually want. There's a whole bunch of concerns about adverse selection, which is what economists call it, when people who actually need the product are going to actually buy it, and the people who know that they're not going to need it or don't think they're going to need it don't buy it. And so the pricing becomes very problematic.
What are we talking about generally? If somebody were interested in a policy, what might it cost them? Off the bat, we know. It's expensive.
It's expensive, yeah. I don't know the latest numbers off the top of my head.
I'd read someplace between $2,000 and $3,500 a year, and that's like obviously a widespread, but it's still for a lot of people. Yeah.
Yeah, and for multiple years, right? Ideally, you're...
Exactly.
From the insurance standpoint, you're paying that for multiple years.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to get into some more of that as we continue with our show here on Radio Times. Long-term care, the demand, costs are rising, and the aging population is growing. Norma Koh is Associate Professor of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the Perelman School of Medicine. Lisa Walk is Chief of the Division of Geriatric Medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Lots of calls and comments to get to. Stay with us as Radio Times continues on WHYY in Philadelphia.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty Moskowane has the day off today. This hour, we're looking at the financial and social trade-offs individuals and families make to afford long-term care for their older loved ones, whether in a nursing facility, an assisted living community, at home. Our guests this hour include Lisa Walk, who is Chief of the Division of Geriatric Medicine and Associate Professor of Medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. And Norma Koh is Associate Professor of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the Perelman School of Medicine. And again, we've got lots of folks who are weighing in this hour. So let's get to a Facebook comment from Nabila, who says she is worried about the growing number of single adults who never had children to help them as they age. When you are isolated as an older person, and as perhaps your health, physical or mental, starts to give you trouble, what are some of the answers? What do you advise your patients whom you see in your practice, Lisa, who are dealing with this?
Yeah, so I would say for sure, the first thing, one of the things you want to do, particularly if you don't have family nearby, children, cousins, nieces, nephews, do you have friends? Do you have someone that you would feel comfortable helping you make decisions and have them start to be engaged in your healthcare on some level? They don't have to make decisions for you, but to at least know what your wishes are, what you're interested in, and so that if there comes a point in time that you're not able to be part of that process, at least someone is familiar and it's not just someone for the first time trying to say that you would want this or that, in order to make sure that what you're really interested in would be the care preferences that you get along the way. So if it's a family member, great, but it's really just more who you're comfortable with, and it can be a friend. If it's not a blood relative, I would really advise people to have advanced care directives, so a healthcare proxy, some legal document that states that this is the person I want to make my decisions or to help me with decisions. And you need to do that while you're cognitively able to do so. So again, doing that sooner rather than later, but then discussing with that person where you would want to live, what kind of care you would want to receive, so that they're comfortable making decisions on your behalf.
And barring that, a family physician?
So your family physician should know what you want regardless, because even if you have that person, they should be familiar and aware. And they may be the ones that help guide that individual in terms of making decisions or when do we make a transition to a different living location.
Norma, did you want to weigh in?
I was going to say, we are seeing some changes in both the healthcare system and private living situations due to this fact. So we are seeing an increase in the Golden Girls phenomenon, where elderly people are living in houses together so that they're not isolated and alone as much. And there's also a growth in geriatric care managers and people like that. Is it different fields? Is it a different job where people usually have like a social work degree or something like that, where they're, escorting people to doctor's appointments and helping them keep everything straight. So there is some response to this as well, that, as this phenomenon increases, we do have some sort of response.
888-477-9499 is the telephone number if you'd like to jump into the conversation. Norma, let's talk about Medicare, choosing an option, the one that might work for you. There are a variety of offerings. It can be a little confusing. Medicare, Medigap policies, Medicare Advantage. Where do you begin?
Fabulous question. But again, this is all separate from the long-term care issues,
yes,
right? Because Medicare won't cover long-term care. So there are websites on CMS to help you with this. People make decisions on Medicare when you look at, ex post, did they make the right decision? The evidence is not great that people are making their decisions very well. But there are things that you can go online, put all your prescriptions in, figure out what is the Part D plan that you want to be covered by. I think that there's this may be the case where choice is too much. Usually we think of choice as a good thing. You can get exactly what you want. But you have to make those decisions that are they're very difficult decisions to decide on health insurance policies.
And in terms of the Medicare Advantage, as Norma was alluding to, they can change. And so your policy this year may cover certain things. Then the next year, maybe it doesn't cover some of the medications or services that you wanted. Oftentimes, people will sign up for a Medicare Advantage because they want the things that traditional Medicare doesn't cover. So, dental care or dentures or hearing aids or like some other those other things. And those things can change. So when you signed up for it, maybe they covered it and the next year they didn't. So each year, you need to look at the policy and see what they're covering as opposed to what they covered the year before.
And important for loved ones to kind of keep an eye on this, because if a person is struggling perhaps with some cognitive decline, that's a maze you have to walk through to try to determine, which Medicare plan is right, and especially as the changes are coming.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get to the phones. Matt in Chester Springs is live with us now on Radio Times. Hello, Matt.
Hello.
Hi. So,
I had a question regarding a individual who does not acknowledge they are deteriorating, so to speak. Going through that currently with my mother, and I was just looking for guidance on how that would be a situation you guys would handle.
Thanks for the call, Matt. in personal experience with elderly loved ones, they can feel frustration when there's a loss of agency. You know, maybe a decision made by their children that, oh, you can't drive anymore. What are good, respectful ways to communicate with an aging person who's experiencing a loss of function?
So I think the first thing is to recognize most people don't recognize that they're having a loss. It's very common for someone to say that they're still doing things that they used to do or no longer are actually doing. But in their mind, you still see yourself as that younger person. And so you are capable of doing those things. And so this is where I think having a good relationship with a healthcare professional, someone who specializes in geriatrics in terms of techniques and ways to talk with your older loved ones, what things do you press on? What things do you kind of let go? Not every battle needs to be fought. And so just some techniques on how to phrase things sometimes so that it's not it's better received by your loved one. And also recognizing what things do you need to kind of take over and what things is it okay that they're doing. I tell my patients and their loved ones, if it's not a safety issue, then it's probably not something you need to really have that battle about. If it's they're not doing something exactly correct, but it's not causing an issue with their safety, then just kind of let that go. If it's something like they're climbing up on things to change a light bulb or, you know, things like that, that is a safety concern, that's a time you might need to step in or to have those conversations that are more difficult.
Facebook comment from Emily: if profit ever gets out of health insurance, we might be able to cover more long-term health care through a single-payer system, Normico. What do you think? Is there a point there? Without making a political statement. But, you know, the profit, industry has to make profit. Companies have to make profit. But costs are high, and this is what people struggle with in terms of trying to cover the enormous cost, perhaps, of caring for somebody who might live well into their late 80s or 90s and who has increasing difficulties.
Yeah, I think regardless of where you get the money, covering long-term care is an expensive proposition. I argue that not covering it is also an expensive proposition. And so it's
what is the fallout?
The fallout is that the families are doing it. The families are stepping up. They're still doing informal care, and that is not costless. We've done some work trying to estimate the cost of caregiving to the caregiver. So it's normally a daughter taking care of a mother. That's the most typical dyad. And, you know, if you take into account the fact that they can't work as much, may need to leave the labor market altogether in order to take care of their loved one, our estimates actually add up to about $80,000 to $100,000 a year that the daughter is taking on in her well-being. There's no money being exchanged, but that's what it would cost to make her just as well off as if she didn't have to take care of her mother, which is, like I mentioned earlier, the exact same price as a nursing home. And so there is a cost. There's a cost to the economy. Somebody's not working. Somebody's taking a lot of leave or something. So there is a cost to the economy of not having this care covered. So it's a matter of monetizing it and making it very clear where the trade-offs are.
Yeah, and that person themselves is not saving retirement benefits and putting stuff in the money in the bank for down the road. Let's talk about just briefly about how much attention this is being given on the national level. Tuesday night's debate, Democratic presidential candidate Amy Klobuchar addressed what she called the elephant in the room, paraphrasing there, when she brought up the issue of long-term care and the need to reduce costs and increase access. I think we've got a clip from Amy Klobuchar.
Okay. We need to make it easier for people to get long-term care insurance. We need to make it easier for them to pay for their premiums. My own dad, I know when his long-term care insurance ends. And then we have some savings for him. He's in assisted living. He got married 3 times, whole nother story, so there isn't much there. But then we go to Medicaid, and I've already talked to Catholic Elder Care. They're willing to take him in. Our story is better than so many other families. We have to make it easier for long-term care.
Okay, so in she mentioned Medicaid there, which who is that a safety net for? That generally is for people of low income, But outside that, if you have a family, you know, and the savings have been spent, the house has been sold, and there's no place else to go, does Medicaid or act as a safety net here too, Norma?
Yes, that's exactly when Medicaid steps in. And so the eligibility rules are slightly different, especially if you're institutionalized in a nursing home. But you do have to essentially impoverish yourself in order to qualify for Medicaid. You can do that by never having any money, or you can do that by having, you know, most people, it doesn't take too many years in $100,000 nursing home to not have enough money to cover those costs anymore and be eligible for Medicaid.
Lisa.
And so I'll add in, so Medicaid is the number one payer of long-term care in the country. So Medicaid, not Medicare. And so typically what happens is that, as you mentioned, if you had resources, a house, you sell the house, the cost of that house goes to the long-term care facility. When that money runs out, and depending on how much your house was worth, it's going to be, you know, 1 to 3, 4 years, then you likely will meet eligibility for Medicaid. You transition to Medicaid and stay in that long-term care facility. So that's typically how it works for someone. If you had assets beforehand, they get turned over to the nursing facility to pay for your care. So if you didn't have it before, obviously then, as Norma mentioned, you're on Medicaid already and they're covering. So that's typically how people wind up paying for it.
Let's continue with our calls. Dan in Chester County, you are live with us on Radio Times. Hello, Dan.
Yes, I'm an architect practicing in Chester County, and I specialize in historic buildings. Some of the large older homes would make sort of ideal houses for this conjoined living arrangement you were talking about with the Golden Girls example. We're working on a property in Eastern Shore, Maryland right now that unfortunately is zoned as a single family, and the definition of family is either married or blood relatives, whereas we would like to encourage the town to open a new zoning category in which unrelated adults can live together, probably over a certain age restricted.
Thanks, Dan. That's an interesting idea. And I'm assuming that if, you know, it takes going to your local town council, talking about zoning, if it were something that you'd want to push forward. Yeah. All right. Jessica in Washington Township, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
I work in geriatric rehab, and I'm so glad you're discussing this topic. It's so important for people to get more information and to know, you know, what the options and availability of other, you know, varieties of services, things like senior daycare programs, veterans assistance programs, as well as family members who are caregivers can apply and get training to be certified as a nursing assistant so that they can actually earn income for caring for their family member. So there are things out there, but they're, you know, the getting that kind of information is so important.
Now, that's an important point. So there are two points there, Jessica, and thanks for the call to Radio Times. First of all, there's so much information out there. Again, you know, it can be challenging to navigate the maze. To whom do you turn to at least get your arms around some of the info if you're starting the search to help an elderly relative or if you are indeed trying to do it by yourself?
Again, probably a little bit biased, but I would say if you're a practitioner that you're seeing, obviously myself as a geriatrician, if you don't have a geriatric practitioner as your primary care provider, you can be seen as a consult by a geriatrician, a geriatric social worker. You know, we live and breathe this. And so in terms of letting people know what options are to either age in place or remain in a location or what additional services, this is one of the things we spend a lot of time doing. And so that I would say it would be a good place to get started. Certainly any social worker can help, but since we deal with it in aging, we deal with it all the time. We're a little bit more prone to be able to give that information quickly to you.
And Norma Coe, Jessica had referenced, I believe, having perhaps even family members somehow earn money to care for their loved ones. You studied a 15-state Medicaid program called the Cash and Counseling Demonstration Program. Now, I don't know if that's, you know, applicable in New Jersey, Pennsylvania, or Delaware, but what is that program about?
So that program allowed people on Medicaid who would have qualified for formal home health care, so a trained professional to come into the home in order to keep them safe and in their able to live at home, to instead of paying an agency to pay their actual family members. It could be friends, it could be family members, it could be anyone that they thought could help them with their care. It was widely successful. They did it in a randomized control trial, which we don't often get in social policy. And it's actually been expanded dramatically. So it started out very small, and it's been expanded dramatically. But it still depends on the state on whether or not you can get paid via Medicaid for helping take care of your family members.
And I believe it is available in Pennsylvania. So I have some patients who have family members who are their home health aide. And so they work for particular agencies. The agency pays the family member, but they have to have some training that they give them. It's not just doing whatever they teach them in terms of transferring and helping the loved ones. And so they are able to have that in Pennsylvania.
That's really good to know, Lisa Walk. And and again, you had said earlier, if people want to know where to go to at least get started in the journeys, to go to a geriatrician, their family doctor. But I wanted to just bring this up. The New York Times reported recently of a shortage of geriatricians, even as the aging population grows. Yes. Why is that?
We have been talking about this in geriatrics for decades. And so there are a lot of factors why. And so, as we know, it's beginning in 2010, the baby boomers started turning 65. So 10,000 people turning age 65 since 2010. And so we have this exponential growth in older adults. But in addition, in terms of medical school and medical school debt, you see a lot of medical students coming out with a vast amount of debt. And so many medical schools now, NYU and others, are trying to decrease that cost by either having tuition free or providing guarantees that you won't leave with more than $75,000 or $100,000 in debt. That's still a lot of debt, but the average medical student without those programs is leaving with even more. So there's a lot of pressure that medical students feel that if you have $250,000 in debt, you want a specialty that you think is going to help you pay that off so you can radiology, you know, there are a lot of them that you can still have a life as well after doing all this training. And so geriatrics is one of the lower paid specialties. And so I think that's where the challenge comes in. Even though people might like it, they feel like they may not be able to cover their burden, their debt, and still go into the field.
We'll talk about some changes in the world of medicine, which is seeking to address this in just a moment after the break. You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. Keep it here. Welcome.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We are talking about the cost of long-term care as the population ages. And I think it's just about 15 years, there will be more older people in this country than children. And that's, I think, a first time in the history of the country. Our telephone number is 888-477-9499. If you'd like to get into the conversation, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Norma Koh is Associate Professor of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the Perelman School of Medicine. Lisa Walk is Chief of the Division of Geriatric Medicine and Associate Professor of Medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. We were just talking briefly, Lisa Walk, going into the break, about the fact that there is really a shortage of geriatricians.
Yes.
Just very quickly to follow that line of thought, the chief of geriatrics at the Yale School of Medicine, you might have worked with her because I know you were there at one point, she envisions geriatricians as a small elite workforce who can help train other medical professionals in elder care, nurse practitioners, pharmacists, physician assistants.
Yes.
So, lest we think that the care might not be there, the care will be there, perhaps in a different form.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things we're trying to do within the field is view geriatrics as not just geriatric medicine, but as you mentioned, geriatric social work, nurse practitioners, and then even individuals who aren't primarily working with older adults. Can we have everyone have some basic knowledge of geriatric principles, providing optimal geriatric care, so that we're working on what we call age-friendly health systems, so that the whole health system has an approach of looking at older adults as a special population and what do we need to do, even if that's not the only population that they deal with. And so we're working on that here at Penn in terms of having more of an age-friendly approach, so that everything that we're doing within our care in the hospital, in our clinics, is more geared towards older adults.
And Normico, we were speaking off mic during the break about the fact that new technologies are evolving as well.
Exactly. We're gonna have to face the changing demographics one way or the other. And one of them is technology. There's technologies that help you live in your home longer. There are technologies that help caregivers do their job and help people live independently or as close to independently as possible, even from afar. So you can have monitoring technologies to see what's in the refrigerator, what's been taken out of the refrigerator. Has someone actually left their bedroom yet for the morning? And so while sometimes it can seem bleak, I think that there will be innovation in this space to help us face all of the problems coming ahead.
And yet there are basic issues, as we were again talking about off mic, of one of our earlier callers had said he's an architect and he's looking to, you know, renovate some of these older homes. And then Lisa Walk, you brought up the point that, you know, as an older person, you don't necessarily want to get into a house with stairs.
Exactly. So
that's not going to change.
No. And unfortunately, sometimes stairs are not our friends. You know, there are a lot of falls that can occur on stairs. Particularly, a lot of people might have their laundry rooms downstairs. They're going down the stairs with the hands full, can onto the handrail. They stumble, cannot break their fall going up the stairs. If your bedroom is upstairs and you have to go upstairs for your bedroom or your bathroom. And again, that's one of the questions you were asking earlier. When do you know you might need to move some place else? Well, if you have stairs and you aren't able to put in a stair lift because of the construction of your home, that might be a time that if you can't live on one level, you need to consider moving to a different location. And so, you know, breaking any bones, you know, hip, arm, legs can really be game changers for older adults. And so we try to decrease that as much. And stairs, unfortunately, tend to be one area that really can be hazardous for older adults.
Surgery, it can carry more risks as you age, Lisa?
Yes. And so older adults are more likely to need emergent or urgent surgery. And in and of itself, having surgery that's not planned is a higher risk. So you're older and then you're having a higher risk surgery. You know, you had an accident and so you're having a traumatic fracture that's unplanned. That in and of itself, regardless of your age, is a higher risk. But then you add on to it being older adult and maybe not having as much of the physiologic reserves in certain areas, your cardiac function, your renal function, your pulmonary function. So you are at higher risk then of having complications.
You are quoted in an article, a Philadelphia Inquirer article, as saying, just because we can do things doesn't mean we should do things. And this is in regards to certain types of surgery. What
yes.
did you mean by that?
Well, I meant that there are a lot of things, as we talk about advances in healthcare and technology and things that we can do. But if it's not in alignment with what the person wants in terms of what matters most to them. So again, with that age-friendly approach, one of the first things we're asking older adults now is what matters to you? If you like going out and going fishing or hanging with your children or whatever activity, and I know that there's a good possibility that if I do this procedure, you'll be alive, but perhaps not able to do those things, then that's maybe something we shouldn't do because it's not going to be in alignment with what matters most to you. And so that's what I'm saying. We can do a lot of things, but if it goes against what you value and goes against the way you want to live your life, then that's perhaps a time that we really should not be doing it.
So confer with your loved ones, you know, before you undergo perhaps a particular surgery to see if this is really the direction that you want.
Well, and have that discussion with whoever.
And your physician, obviously.
Right, with your physician and your loved ones. And so ask, I really enjoy X. Will I still be able to do this after this procedure is done?
Okay. Norma, is it better to rehab at home or in a skilled nursing facility? Some might say the obvious answer is at home. Not necessarily. I thought I saw your name associated with an article like that. Well, I think, and here's where we're going. A recent Forbes article talked about hospitals. You know, they're discharging patients sometimes, you know, quicker and sicker. Mm-hmm. And family members are actually stepping in to do the care that might have once been done by, say, registered nurses. And I know we talked about training for some of these family members. But then, you know, there was also a question raised in this article about whether they can actually do some of the care, like, you know, changing dressings on surgical incisions and perhaps recognizing whether there is an issue, managing medications, medical equipment, that sort of thing. So I'm going to, you know, just kind of switch over to Lisa for just a moment. At what point do you know, as a family member trying to care for an older person who's out of surgery and at home, is it really better to have that person in a skilled nursing facility?
Depends on the person and what supports you have for them at home. So before they leave, we would have that person, depending on what the surgery, be seen by physical therapy, for example. And the physical therapist would be able to say, are they able to transfer from bed to chair independently, or do they need two people, let's say, to help them transfer, or for them to ambulate safe, to walk safely, do they need two people? Well, if you only have one person with you at home, then that really makes home not a safe, viable option. And so before you leave, we'll have a better assessment of what you're able to do in that current state, not what you did before, but what you're able to do since that surgery. And that helps guide the decision. For some people, home may be better if they have the supports that they need there and it's in their environment. They just have to be able to maneuver what they normally do in their environment. You're more likely to not only be comfortable, but if you have any issues with even mild cognitive impairment, home is going to be better. It's familiar. You're less likely to be delirious. You're less likely to have those issues. If you have certain conditions, though, like a stroke, for example, if you can get into acute rehab, that's going to be best because we know the 6 months after that event is when you're most likely to recover. So you really want to push therapy then, and that's best done in acute rehab. So depends on the reason why you need rehab, of what location may be the best for you to functionally get back to where you were before that event.
Norma, let's get back to retirement for just a moment. How do we plan for retirement and future care? Let's talk about work, plans, Social Security. Do most Americans have enough to retire on when they decide to call it a day at the job?
I think that's a huge debate. Depending on the models and the assumptions that you make, people are vastly under-saving to, you know, we'll all muddle through. I think that people largely ignore the long-term care cost when making these decisions about how much to save, and they think about how long they're going to live, but they don't think about their quality of life or what they're going to need during that lifespan. So my view is that people are probably underestimating how much they want to live for the lifestyle in which that they want, and so wind up relying on Medicaid and social safety net programs and their families much more than they think they're going to.
Is there a rule of thumb for trying to plan? Say you're 60 and, you know, we don't know whether it's going to be 70, 75, 90. I mean, it's amorphous.
Yeah, so everyone's thumb is different.
So really, you kind of have to get good at guesstimating, perhaps, you know, just looking ahead and maybe trying to cover all possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, there are online calculators you can use to try to figure out exactly what is your what is the target savings rate. You have to make assumptions about how long you're going to live, how much you want to consume during those years. Are you going to be traveling all the time or not? What is your healthcare costs? It really depends on what your pension benefits are going to be if you have one. You know, Social Security is about the only thing that is known in these calculations, is that you know how much you've worked and you know how much benefits you can get depending on when you claim.
And yet Social Security is a whole nother show.
It's a whole nother show.
and its viability, I should say. We have a Facebook comment from Joanne who says, my parents worked very hard all their lives and saved for retirement. And this is to the point, I guess. Then my father was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. My mother was his caretaker at home for 10 years, and we watched their savings go to pay for the nursing home. I mean, who knows that, you know, you just don't know if Parkinson's will be a part of the future.
So, exactly.
So it's oversave.
It's very easy to have a scenario where someone develops a disability. These things don't tend to sort of be short term. You could have either a cognitive decline or some other physical disability 4 to 5 years down the road, even when family steps in for the first few years. Eventually, they need more care. It's very easy to see a $300,000 bill for long term care if you don't have any insurance, if you're not poor enough for Medicaid to step in and cover that bill for you. So it's very easy to have scenarios where a disability can
nightmare scenarios
can be bankrupting.
Yeah. Email from Lucy. By the time my in-laws were moved to assisted living, they were too confused to be able to coordinate their insurance. If we had not been willing and able to intervene at each missed payment, the insurer would have failed to give the coverage they had been paid to give. Lisa Walk, you are nodding your head.
Yes. Yeah, so that is a challenge. As you mentioned, by the time you realize and you step in, they could have already canceled you. There are some policies with insurance that you can, once you get to a certain age, usually it's over 65, 70, that you can name someone to also be notified that you've made your payment or not. And so that way, they, every time you make a payment, if there's one that's missed, that person also gets a notice, by the way, this payment has not been received. And so it doesn't get to the point where they're almost to be canceled. You can see and know right away, okay, they missed a payment, you know, either pay it or try to find out what's going on with your parent. And so you want to be as proactive as possible with this process.
So critically important to get your name on that policy.
Exactly.
And also to be aware,
yes,
as children or as loved ones, friends, and et cetera, that this might be the case with a, you know, an elderly loved one down the road.
And I think going back to our earlier comment, you know, oftentimes people think they're less impaired than they are, that they're still holding together. So the parent may not say to you, I need help paying my bills, or I haven't paid this. If you're not proactive or maybe looking at the checkbook or checking the policy or getting the mail, you wouldn't know. They're not necessarily going to mention it to you that that's an issue. So oftentimes when people find out is at that late stage, or they go to get the help and the policy was canceled sometime before and they didn't know. And so so you can't just say, oh, well, they'll let me know if they need help.
Mm-hmm.
You need to offer a little bit, be a little bit more proactive.
Yeah, it speaks to the need to be compassionate in kind of watching for a loss of agency and then addressing that to the older person, with
yes,
the older person.
Yeah. Financial problems remain the number one indicator for cognitive impairment. Right. That's typically when the family finds out that something's off.
Norma Coe, I'm not sure if this is in your wheelhouse, but Nancy asks, what are the rules for people who have parents give over their money and homes to their kids so they appear to be poorer for their medical expenses?
Yeah, so there are ways to do that. And if you Google estate planning and Medicaid estate planning, you will find a lot of lawyers that are willing to help you with things like this. I will say that it's not a guaranteed way to save your assets. There are Medicaid look-back periods, and so you have to have made a transfer over 5 years before you even apply for a nursing home to even be considered. So it's... there are people who do it, I'm sure, but it's not a riskless strategy.
Can your guests talk about the sandwich generation? That's another email. I'm not familiar with that term. What is that?
So the sandwich generation is someone who's taking care of both their
parents, okay,
as well as their children. And so they are caregiving on both sides of the spectrum. So
caregiver burnout, resources.
Yeah.
Again, go see the family provider, maybe step one.
That would definitely be a step one place to be able to say what are you eligible for. Someone mentioned in one of the comments earlier, there are programs like adult day programs. If you're still working and you're taking care of your loved one, can they be in a safe and stimulating environment while you're still working during the day? And so being able to be aware of those types of programs. And oftentimes they'll pick up the loved one as well. So there are ones that have vans that'll, so you don't have to drop them off and pick them up. They can be picked up and dropped off. And so there are ways that while you're trying to manage both your parents and your children to utilize the resources available to you as much as possible.
I'd also plug the area agencies on aging. They're also very helpful in knowing what is in your area, because it varies so much on where you live, what's going to be available and what you're going to qualify for.
So good resources to start.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're looking for a geriatrician, you know, it may not be quite, start with the family physician first, because we are in need of more geriatricians in this country.
Yeah.
Lisa Walk, I just wanted to ask you, you know, why this field for you?
Well, there's a lot of reasons, but I think one of the things that inspired me when I was an intern, so my first year of my residency after graduating from medical school, I had a geriatrician that was one of my attendings, and she encouraged me to consider the field. And when I started thinking about it more, one of the things I really valued with my older adult patients is oftentimes being willing to share their kind of lessons learned, things that they had done well or things that they wish they had done differently in their lives, and wanted to make sure I had a better life or didn't make the same mistakes or did the same things they did. And I felt like it was much more of an exchange between myself and my patients, where I was helping them with my medical knowledge and what would help them to have high quality life. And they were trying to help me have high quality of life by telling me things. And I've continued to have that throughout my, you know, my career, that this exchange back and forth. And that's one of the things I enjoy most about geriatric medicine.
So a plug for geriatric medicine there.
Absolutely.
So Norma Coe, we've got about 20 seconds left. Any thoughts for people who might be going through this phase of life and their loved ones in terms of financial planning and where to even begin to have the conversation?
I think begin early and often. Don't be afraid to have it. If you ask children, adult children, they want to have this conversation and are terrified of bringing it up to their parents. Parents think the kids already know. And so just have it early and often and be prepared.
All right. Norma Coe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Norma Coe is Associate Professor of Medical Ethics and Health Policy at the Perelman School of Medicine. And Lisa Walk, a pleasure as well.
Thank you.
Lisa is Chief of the Division of Geriatric Medicine and Associate Professor of Medicine at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. Our engineer today has been Al Banks. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.